Hello, and welcome to House Einstein Podcast 42. My name is Osman Parvez. I'm the employing broker of the House Einstein Brokerage, and I'm the host of this podcast.
My name is Hamish Crabb, and I am the right-hand man to the brokerage. Help keep the brokerage running, and for this purposes, I'm also producing the podcast and being a lovely host, I hope. So, yeah.
Good afternoon, Hamish.
Pleasure to be here, Oz.
The topics today, we are going to be talking a little bit about market conditions. I did an analysis for a client this week, and we'll talk about what that revealed about the city of Boulder and the housing market. We're going to talk a little bit about some of our process in developing the right story for marketing a property. We've been working on a listing that has a story that's very unique and worth telling to distinguish it from some of its competition. We're going to talk about the sale of the week. And as usual, we seem to have more than one just because there's stuff to talk about with both of these properties and both of them deserve some conversation. So we're going to be talking about the sale of 4380 Whitney Place. And we'll be talking about the sale of 421 Mapleton Avenue, Unit A. And then there's some news articles, news items that I think are very much worth discussing. There's a micro apartment development that the city is contemplating. The city council here in Boulder will be reviewing the applicant's attempt to get this permitted. And I say attempt because sometimes that's what it's like in the city. We're going to be talking about Barbara Corcoran, who recently was on the Tim Ferriss podcast. And I am a fan of Barbara. As somebody who's also from the New York, well, I was born in the New York metro area. She's really from New York, but I always feel a sense of affection when I hear her talking and I hear those New York City accents. We'll be talking briefly about this new movie, The Civil War, even though it seems like it's a stretch when it comes to how that relates to the housing market, but it does.
And we can make it work.
We will make it work.
Yeah.
And in the Tell Me Something I Don't Know segment today, we're going to be talking about what you're paying for as a consumer of real estate services. So if you're out there looking to buy or sell and you're thinking about hiring an agent, what are you paying for? And after 20 years in this business, I'm fairly convinced that most people actually don't know what they're really paying for or think what they're paying for is one thing when what they're actually getting is something quite different. And that mismatch is something that is fascinating, even 20 years in this industry. I'm fascinated by it. I think it's worth talking about. And then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah. Should be a pretty solid little podcast here. So
should be a solid one. Unlike last week, hopefully we'll keep this to the hour long window or so. We really pushed it to that was probably one of our longest ones. We did have a good time. Normally they're about an hour long, and we're going to have a good time this time as well.
Yeah. A good time constrained time. Anyway.
Well, before we get too far down the rabbit hole, before we jump in with both feet, let's talk about our mission. Mm. Here at the House Einstein Podcast, our mission is to help you make a smarter real estate decision. That is the same as our brokerage. That's what we're all about. That is the distinguishing factor between us and the vast majority of other brokerages and real estate agents out there. That is our singular focus when we serve you as a buyer or seller or as a listening audience, with one caveat. If you're not a client, if you're not currently working with a real estate agent in the House Einstein Brokerage, first, you probably should consider that. But if you're not, then this podcast is entertainment. And do not go making your real estate decisions based on what you hear in this podcast. This is purely here to entertain you. And if you're thinking about buying or selling and you would actually like professional advice, work with your chosen real estate agent or your real estate advisor. If you don't have that person and you happen to be in our local market, we are more than happy to help you. You can find us at houseeinstein.com. And we focus in the Denver metro. I do a lot of deals in Boulder, but also into the foothills and mountain towns, including some of the resort towns. I've gone as far as Colorado Springs and as far north, as far south as Colorado Springs. Those for past clients, people that I had an existing relationship with, as well as into Fort Collins. And people sometimes really want to work with me. And if they are past clients, we will happily do that. If you are not a past client, we might find you a referral partner. But that's our footprint.
Yeah. It's a good one.
All right. I think we can jump in. What do you think?
I think so. You made some Instagram posts earlier this week.
All right. So one of the things we have begun doing with our clients, and this isn't a recent thing, but one of the things we have begun doing with our clients, we started this maybe 4 years ago, and it just keeps getting more effective and faster, is we do a regular review of the competition. And I'm at the point now where I think we should just have it automatically recur with our clients as a meeting on my calendar, Hamish, where with our listings, our sellers, once a week we should be going through the competition and we should be talking about market conditions. We should see what new properties popped up and what ones went under contract, and have any of the competitors in our competitive landscape sold and what did they sell for. If one did go under contract, we might want to ask, how many offers did they get? How long was it on the market? What was the negotiated discount? And because of how Boulder real estate works and our relationship with the real estate community, almost always I can get essential information from the listing agent. They may not tell me exactly what the under contract price is, but they give me enough information to help me communicate with our clients. So I was going through that process for one of our listings, going through the analysis of what's going on in preparation for this meeting with clients who have a listing in Newlands. And I wanted to really dive a little deeper into sales volume during the month of March, because we did touch on it briefly. And the quarter, so I like to look at these things in quarters, because there's enough data in the city of Boulder after a quarter to say, all right, that could be a trend. 1 month's data is not a trend, but 2 or 3 months start to look like a trend. And I pulled up sales volume for the city of Boulder to give them a sense of, you know, what happened last month. Now, our listing is really an April listing, but we hadn't done this analysis, and I was really surprised. So if you go to my Instagram, and you can find it at Instagram, just look for me personally. My name is Osman Parvez, OsmanParvez. That's my Instagram handle.
I'll there put is it not in the a whole description.
There's not a whole team of analysts that put this together, but you can see I put it together. This is the stuff I was, you know, I cut my teeth on when I worked in the investment community, was analyzing various types of assets and trying to get a better sense of what was going on so I could then advise the principals in our firm, you know, the investment committee people. And I was really shocked to see that sales volume. So if you look at this chart, the blue shaded area, this is for the city of Boulder.
And this is the shaded chart, not the line chart.
Well, it's a line chart with a shaded area.
I guess the graph before the most recent one.
You're gonna put a link in the description, and you may want to, if you're on YouTube watching this, I think we can just put this chart up as a little image Hamish. Just make a note, we'll do that. So this shows it's blue. It shows City of Boulder sold volume, and the line in the chart it represents the last 12 months. It ends in March. So this is a 12-month look back, and the line is the most recent data, and then the shaded area is the 3-year average, and that's the preceding 3 years. So it is not inclusive of the last 12 months. And the idea of this chart is to show you how the market has performed relative to the average of the last few years. And one thing to keep in mind is that we're now past really the frenzy of COVID. The frenzy of COVID would have been the 3 months ending March 2021, right? That would have been, the market had unlocked in the summer of 2020. It was nuts. And then ended this, if it was on this chart, it would be ending March 2021. This is not 2021. It's 2023. Oh, no, it is 2000. So I apologize. No, that is in the average. So we'll look at that too. We'll dig a little deeper. So that is part of the average in this chart. But what you can see is that during the last 12 months, the last 3 months, the market started to recover in January and February, and then in March it plunged downward. Mm. And it plunged downward to the point where it's 24% below last year's sales volume and 32% below that three-year average, with the caveat is the three-year includes that time period with COVID. And then if you look back earlier than January, so the April through January period, the whole 9 months, the market was just trailing the average. And these, because we have a data scientist as clients who really go down these rabbit holes, they insist that I put the standard deviation in. So the Good. Lines in this chart, the vertical lines are the standard deviation. Hat tip to Tyler. And you can see when we've been outside that standard deviation and how wide the standard deviation was and in those months following COVID. I also went a little further down the rabbit hole because I wanted to see, okay, how much pressure is building in the market? Because sales this year are significantly down compared to the previous year and dramatically down compared to the 12 months that ended in 2022. So in the time period that ended in in March of 2022, which is all of which is 9 months of 2021 and the first 3 months of 2022, there were 1,206 sales in the city of Boulder for detached single family houses. But then by the following 12 months, this is hard to describe when you're talking about these last 12 month periods.
No kidding. But
the last 12 month period ending in March of 2023, so a year ago, there were only 873 sales. So that means it was a decline of, run it through the calculator, 27.6% year over year. And that was last year. And this year, what happened? Well, we're down again. We're down another 5.3%. So this year, the year ending 2024, March ending, the last 12 months ending in March of 2024, we have only 827 sales. Jeez. And that is not because of lack of demand. That is largely because of lack of supply below 3 million. Above 3 million, as we've pointed out in other podcasts, there's not a lot of inventory under contract. So there's a tug of war happening in some ways between buyers and sellers above 3 million, where they have a lot of selection and there's downward pressure on prices. And as you cascade down that waterfall in prices, there's less and less downward pressure to the point where we know there's almost nothing below a million that is worth buying. And no offense to our listeners, sellers with single-family detached houses below a million, but they're often in really rough condition, and they still sell very quickly. Mm-hmm. And in that 1-2 range, and I might break this out into another analysis, Hamish, but as you move up the tranches, the market shifts from being a seller's market to very much above 3 million. It's a buyer's market. Okay.
Yeah, you jumped into it. I was going to bring it up during the show notes while we were planning, but I wanted to kind of like surprise you with it. But you already got into it. Kind of when you break down by price, the data changes quite dramatically. So you got there, yeah.
Market conditions vary dramatically by price. If you're shopping above 3 million in the city of Boulder, you really should be selective, and you have leverage to negotiate a better deal, especially on a listing that's been on the market a while. Mm. If you're under a million, it's the opposite. And in that 1-3 range, it really depends on price range. Well, it depends on location, property type, condition. And that analysis is something you should be doing when you go into the war room with your agent and you're thinking about writing an offer. To understand how competitive is the market for this particular property is not rocket science. It just takes looking back at the data. And one of our favorite things to do is just look at the last 12 months relative to your specific price range and location, see what else sold and ask yourself, would any of these other houses work for you? Mm-hmm. And if the answer is a lot of them would have, well, you can negotiate more aggressively because you know there's probably going to be another one. But if the answer is, oh my God, nothing like this house sold in the last 12 months, sold in the last 24 months, well, you may want to be aggressive at that point. I mean, you should still look at price, look at price per square foot, look at some of the other homes in the neighborhood that may be sold, or maybe other homes like this house but weren't in the neighborhood, and make some adjustments based on views and open space and all those things. But you really want to. Yeah. I mean, otherwise you're just throwing a dart in the dark and hoping that you're not overpaying.
And then you become an interesting data point for us to augur.
Right. Yeah. Right. You become a very interesting. If you overpay dramatically, we will notice.
We'll see.
And we will not name you when we shame you. But we will. There may be some shaming involved if you bring it back on the market, trying to get your money back in a year, because that does not often happen. The market is not that forgiving in a normal environment. But you may, you know, good thing you might say. Well, one thing you might say is, hey, that's great at the city level. What about the county? What about a bigger data set? Do we still see do we still see that building pressure? Something I like to call the Augustus Gloop effect. And, you know, that's from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, with that kid gets stuck in the chocolate water, the river and the waterfall that mixes the chocolate, and mm-hmm. there's that German kid that's like going hog wild, and then he falls in, and then he gets stuck in the tube, and Willy Wonka's like, there's pressure building, it's going to explode. That's sort of what I think of in the market, and we absolutely see the same phenomena. So for example, in the city of in Boulder County, with the last 12 months ending March, there were 2,804 single family detached sales, 2,800 roughly. And when you look back a year earlier, that is March of 2023, the preceding 12 months, you're at 2,928. So the difference between this year and last year is not that massive, but it's 4.2% fewer sales. And then you do the difference between 23 and 22, and you're at 25% fewer sales. There were 3,912 sales in the 12 months ending March of 2022. Yeah. And it fell off a cliff from March of 2022 to March of 2023. 25% fewer sales. And when I look back at time periods even earlier than that, you don't see years. I mean, I went back to all the way to 2018. None of those years have below 3,000 sales in Boulder County.
Mm. Wow.
And equivalent in the city of Boulder, you know, where we have fewer than 900 sales, there are no years that had fewer than 900 sales until last year and this year. And the reason I think that this is building pressure is because people don't buy and sell real estate like you would buy and sell items at a grocery store shelf, when the people buy and sell, it's usually around a life event. It's around household formation. Maybe there's a death in the family. Maybe there's a job change. Maybe there's a divorce. All these things tend to create the motivating factor to buy or sell real estate. Maybe you're entering your first professional job, mm-hmm. and you have good income and you have some savings or other assets that have come into your name, and suddenly you're buying a house. You could wait for a while, but your need to buy a house is not satisfied by renting a house. They're not equivalents. And even though a lot of people would like to believe they are not. Owning the asset and investing in the community and repairing and maintaining and improving that asset are a completely different mentality to just renting it for a period of time. Given your lack of security and knowing this is yours to stay for as long as you like. I mean, it's a completely different experience. So, building pressure, but the market's also dipping. And prices are correcting. And the only way to really know is to look at it very closely by property type, price range, location. And if you're listing, it's to look at it weekly. And that's now what we're doing. We've been doing it, but now let's just invite our clients to join us at the meeting. It's so much more effective and efficient. We just do a live video call. We go through it. We talk about the new competitors. Maybe I schedule showings on those competitors just to verify what we think we've learned online. And I don't know, Hamish, the number of people that schedule showings on our listings, like one hand we can count them.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's so rare that people, we just had one.
The crickets.
That just scheduled. He scheduled it as a preview, mm-hmm. which is legit.
This is the one for tomorrow. Yeah.
No, it's the one last week.
Oh, okay. There's a new one for tomorrow.
Okay. Yep. I didn't know that. Yeah, there's an agent, I won't mention his name, that's scheduled one for tomorrow on this listing. But, excuse me. No, last week there was an agent that scheduled a showing. He has a competitive listing. I pardon me for the coughing. Yeah, bless I'm almost you. Over this cold. And that's what you should do, because how do you know how competitive your listing is unless you go see the competition? Yeah. And it's just shocking how few agents do it. So, all right, let's keep moving.
Now, I thought you were gonna
stuck here.
Pivot gracefully to your next post, which because you were talking about the price change, where your next post is the median dollar per square foot.
Oh, no, not going to that. Okay. I don't want to. It would take another half an hour, and so this is the problem: is that
right?
I could easily talk for prices about prices for half an hour, and then what I'm going to want to show you movement by price range, and it would be in its own podcast. I mean,
we could just go forever. That. Yeah.
No, I just would suggest you look at the difference between the county and the city, and the county did not see that drop last month.
Mm-hmm.
And the county is inclusive of the city, of course, but the county is a much bigger data set. Oh, so yeah. The number of sales actually last month were not off. They were actually 10% above last year and just 5.9% below the average of the preceding 3 years. And it basically is well within the standard deviation. So that now the chart's brown, same exact data. I may have labeled it sold houses versus sales volume, but it's the exact same data.
Mm.
And that's just something to understand when you're thinking about the Boulder housing market. And we've talked about competitive benchmarking. So I think we covered that.
Yeah, we did cover going out to see other listings. If the story didn't make sense online, we wanted to go out and check those.
Here's the thing. When should you care about this? And the reason this came up as a topic in our podcast today is that we are likely to list the property in North Boulder in the next couple of months. And these are past clients, but they've never actually sold a house. And they're asking me lots of questions. And they dropped this little sentence in the last email that said, oh, by the way, we're interviewing other agents. And I said... And they said, no, please don't take offense. We just want to hear what they have to say. And I'm not offended. I think that's great. You should interview other agents. But then come back to me so we can talk about it, because often other agents are going to have a lot of smoke, mirrors, and marketing fluff that is not real. And I don't mind losing to my competition when they actually offer better service. Things that actually make a difference in your transaction.
When it makes sense, and right?
If they can do that for a better commission price that I'm charging you, okay, I'm willing to improve and I'm willing to compete, and maybe I don't get every listing. I'm okay with that. But what drives me crazy is when people
we can't compete on personality either. You know, like agent X because they're your buddy.
Well, they're your buddy, or maybe you just like this person. They're physically attractive. They're pleasant. They're really nice to be around.
I wasn't going
to
say it, but yeah.
Okay, but look, yeah. there's very attractive agents out there. Physically, they look like movie stars. They're very good looking. I can't compete on good looking. But honestly, I feel like no one's going to outcompete me on how hard I'm going to work.
Right.
And so our list of services, we just, in response to that email, I dusted off our list of services, which I have not updated to my shame. Like, this is the one pager you give a new prospective seller. Like, okay, here's seller. We don't know each other. Here's my one pager of our services. There were like 8 new things on that list of things we do that weren't there 3 years ago. And competitive benchmarking is one of those things that's now actually, as of a couple of weeks ago, inviting our clients to be part of that process every week. Mm-hmm. So they feel like they know what's going on. I don't know any other agents that do that. And I definitely don't know many agents that pick up the phone and call you for feedback. We're doing that with every showing. Attended showings, that's something some agents do. The majority don't, but the better ones do. They actually go to the showing because the buyer's agent's clueless. So there are all these things that that this whole weekly competitive benchmarking came up because I really wanted to help our clients understand all the extra things we're doing that most agents just don't do.
Yep.
And also encouraging other agents on the team to help people see, like understand the things that we're doing that actually add value that other agents, to our best of our knowledge, are not doing.
I have a friend who is, their house is currently listed. And because I'm in the industry, I get to hear so much. And I haven't told you about it, Osman, or anything. And the home is still active, though I think they're going to pull it. But there's a lot that I've heard, and a lot of complaints and a lot of interesting feedback. So yeah, I'm excited to get into that too, kind of just on the, they feel like they've been left out of the loop and they're not hearing enough information and they're not getting the full picture from their agent. And I think our weekly competitive benchmarking really does help kind of remove, become more, it's just transparency, right? You get to see what we see. We have the experience and the knowledge to kind of guide on that. And then you can also use your own intuition, and it's a melting pot together. So I did a good job. I hid this, I obscured their identity still. And I plan to until that's all said and done. But man, do I get to hear all of the things.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, good. That's how we learn. And it's actually with our clients that tell us, hey, this other agent's showing up for every showing, or this other agent mm-hmm. made sure the lights are on. If we didn't know other agents were doing that, we wouldn't know that that's something that we should be doing better at. Although I got to say, it's, you know, I still feel firmly like we're doing a lot more than most agents, but oh, yeah. we won't learn about the competition unless we hear about it from our clients that have considered other agents. And it was the sale of, I think I can talk about this. Should I mention the address? All right, I'm just going to mention the address, and hopefully it does not.
I'll make a point on the time code.
I'll mention the street.
Okay.
So this is before your time, Hamish.
Okay.
We listed a home on Dewey Avenue. And it was a historic property that I helped my clients acquire, and it was like the fourth or fifth transaction within the family. Mm. So we had represented their parents, their elderly parents, on the acquisition, sale, and acquisition of another property, right? So this was like the fourth or fifth transaction, and this client, who's a really smart doctor, said to me, "Osman, I want to know what you're actually doing. Like, I don't want you to just send me
an itemized bill
that says, yeah, I want to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
And I want you to do these extra things." And I thought about it and I said, okay, well, that's how the marketing and communication plan started, Hamish. Oh, that's okay. Why that's an attachment.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to know what we're actually doing. Because otherwise I would just write full service on that field.
Sounds good on a billboard.
Full service sounds great.
Yeah.
Sounds good in all sorts of ways. But, in reality, it wasn't very clear what we were doing at that time prior to that listing in April of 2021. So this is 3 years ago is when the marketing and communications plan was born. It's now an attachment with every listing agreement, and it specifies what exactly we're doing, the feedback system, the staging consultation. We've now decided to include staging in our listings, the professional photography, the professional videography. You know, we typically don't share our marketing budget, but we have one for every listing. We're spending money on every listing beyond the MLS.
Oh yeah.
And the reason we don't share the budget is because it depends,
mm-hmm.
right? Like if we're already under contract out of the first week, we're not going to go spend thousands pushing a listing that's already under contract. But we are going to spend a lot of money and resources and time on every listing.
That's right.
And we specify that, and we talk about the channels of distribution. Where does it go? And I'm always happy to hear what other agents are doing and learn from it, like the open house. For many, many years, I said open houses are a waste of time. It's really just for rookie agents to collect leads.
Yep.
That's the only value. And I was chastised and admonished by a group of lady realtors who are colleagues of mine who've been in the business a long time. And they told me I was dead wrong. And when three of these lady realtors are all, you know, on my case about this, I'm like, okay, I could be wrong on this.
I'm imagining a visual. They're in like a semicircle around you, and you're in some stool, and there's just a light on you.
Yeah, that's what it felt like. They're like, Osman, you're wrong. They said half the time they either get a new client or they sell the house 50% of the time through an open house. And I was like, okay, well, I mean, the new client thing is great, but you're not actually selling the house. And they feel very strongly it's worth the investment of their time and money to advertise and attend and to create open houses. So now it's an option. My argument back was it's mostly looky-loos, and sometimes those looky-loos will turn off the actual buyer by complaining about having petty grievances against the house that the
You've had that looky-loo too. I've
had that exact story where it's the real buyers in the house and a bunch of looky-loo open house people that's all they do is go to open houses on the weekends. That's what they like doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then they like trashing the house while they're walking through it Right, they're having their coffees, which they shouldn't even have in the house. And they're walking around talking about all the problems with this house. And meanwhile, the real buyer is like, I would never have even thought about any of those things. So there you have it. All right, that's our context of why we're talking about competitive benchmarking. Last week, we told you about a new listing we have coming up in Gold Run. And this week, we got the property staged, and we're out there filming and doing photography. And we're trying to get this on the market pretty quickly. We've benchmarked it against the competitors. We actually visited the competitors. We're pretty confident on the price point. And the question then becomes, how do we tell this property's story with our photography and videography? And I can tell you that there's an advantage to knowing the complex, to knowing the neighborhood, to knowing the property type and how it compares to others. Mm. And this is a classic example of why it's so important to choose somebody who really understands these things about your specific property and knows how to tell the property's story. So you would think Gold Run, well, it's just a high-density, student-infested apartment complex. What's the difference between Gold Run and all of these other developments in Boulder? And it turns out a huge difference. Gold Run's right on the Boulder Creek path. It's right next to Scott Carpenter Park. You could walk to Target. You could ride your bike to Whole Foods. You could hop on your bike and be downtown in 10 minutes. Health club that actually has usable amenities that are super useful. But within, and of course, you can get onto the CU campus in minutes.
Yeah.
And it's just a really pleasant place to live because of its proximity to the creek itself. Like that riparian corridor is such a nice place to be in the summertime. We used to take our dog into the swimming hole that's right next to Gold Run. And he would jump in and we would hang out there in the summer. And he would actually run laps. He would run and jump into the waterfall that's mixing right there. And then hop back out. He'd swim over and then get out. He'd run laps. Jumping in. He was so into it.
Oh, dang. That's adorable.
I used to jump in there, too, prior to the E. coli counts getting high and older. But that's another topic for another day. That's not selling Gold Run. But if you didn't know all this about Gold Run, you wouldn't really be able to properly tell that property's story. And I happen to have lived at Gold Run when I first moved to Boulder. And that really gives me an advantage in understanding why this complex is so attractive to live in. And then there's one more level of nuance. And this you would only know if you have seen these units at Gold Run many times over the years. So the penthouse units that often have three bedrooms, the loft can be converted into an additional bedroom. And many of the owners have done that. I'm not sure if it's with a permit or not, but they treat it like an additional bedroom. And the loft has vaulted ceilings. The top floor has vaulted ceilings. So it feels very spacious at those top floor levels. And they often sell for $100,000, $200,000, sometimes more, $300,000, more than the second floor units that might even be similar of size. And our listing is a second floor unit, but it is the optimal layout in a building that has the sprinkler system. And the sprinkler system is there because, well, buildings burned at Gold Run. Because of careless students that set fire to the stick frame structure. You can't smoke at Gold Run and you can't have gas-fired barbecues at Gold Run anymore. But one thing you notice when you look in our building, of our listing, is those sprinklers.
Yeah.
So it has the best layout for roommates or family. It is very spacious. It's the size of a South Boulder ranch. It has an underground parking space with elevator access. And then the health club facilities are fantastic. So I'm super confident our listing is going to fly off the market because of all those factors. Plus, we staged it and we know how to tell the story. So Hamish and I were very much engaged in how do we tell the story of the Gold Run condos, this particular unit. And Hamish, how do you think, what's your take on all of this being the master behind the camera?
No, I think you nailed it. One of the, I guess, more striking things that hit me, cause we were just there this morning, is I went to go shoot the volleyball court, just get another shot of it. And I just had that like kind of tinge of, oh, wow, this is a really cool place to live because you can just run down and there's going to be other people playing volleyball all summer. You just kind of know it. And so if you can just go and meet people immediately where you live, like your vicinity it's just a really cool place to live. Talking in circles here, but no, I think he nailed it.
Volleyball courts, tennis courts, community gardens, sauna, hot tub, indoor pool, Workout equipment. The gym room is perfectly adequate.
Well, yeah. You're
gonna save on a gym membership. I mean, it's just one thing after another that just works at Gold Run.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a very intelligent purchase. The next nearest complex with those type of amenities is the Peloton. And Peloton,
yeah, that's luxury.
There was one big advantage. So the Peloton was designed to limit sound transfer between the units. There's a lot of concrete in the walls. And the price points are almost double.
Yeah.
Right? Like for the same kind of unit, you're not even going to get close to the square footage, but you're going to get nicer amenities, a much higher HOA, and less sound transfer between units.
Mm-hmm.
And sound transfer isn't that bad. I lived in Gold Run. I don't think it's a big deal, but you might hear the neighbors occasionally. So that is something to know with any stick frame construction building.
Though on the second floor, at least you're, you know.
Right. You have one unit above you.
One less to worry
about.
That's another
reason the third floor is even more optimal. But it's, you know, we're talking about price points that are now approaching $1 million for very similar square footage. One just closed, actually. Yeah.
And speaking of square footage, too, it's a larger unit. And there are some single-story ranches in South Boulder that have less square footage than this condominium. Right. So,
well, and there's some bad layouts at Gold Run. So let's also be honest. Some of the units that are right adjacent to the creek, for example, first, there is no garage because you're right next to the creek. And
oh, really?
Didn't know the layout is really dysfunctional. Like the kitchen is this – the kitchen dining area is like – like a galley that is
it's much more kind of college.
It feels very not nice.
Yeah.
Like emotionally, it does not feel very good. I mean, that's why, you know, I've sold so many of these units at Gold Run over the years. I know this, like, I feel confident telling buyers that this is actually the optimal layout. Short of spend another $300 to $350 and you can get the upper level. But if you don't want to spend that money and you want the 2-bedroom layout, this works.
The one.
This is a really good choice. Yeah, this is the one.
Dare I say it's two primary suites? Because each bedroom has its own bathroom, and then they both have so much closet space.
The bedrooms are huge. Yeah. The bedrooms are massive. This is such a nice unit.
Oh, they each have their own balcony? That's also wicked.
Right.
Yeah.
That's true.
There's storage outside for your bike.
That's right. There's more storage. Yeah you should have. I frankly think you should have bought this instead of the house you bought, but then you wouldn't be able to have your car collection.
No, and happening. I don't think with rates I'd be able to swing it, but dang.
Not today.
Dreams are free, yeah. Maybe next.
All right, let's move on.
Yeah.
What do we got? Sale of the week. So there's two properties I want to talk about today. 4380 Whitney Place and 421 Mapleton Ave. And with 4380 Whitney, I happen to know this location pretty well because I've sold homes on the street, lived nearby. We property managed a home on the street for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And
just kind of let me
pull up the cards. Sale of the week.
And there, if you'd like to pull it up yourself, it's in the description.
Yep. 4380 Whitney Place. So home was built in the 60s. So Majestic Heights is the neighborhood. It's right across Table Mesa from Martin Acres, very similar style houses, and a little bit newer, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years newer than most of Martin Acres, which was built in the 50s. And this particular house really is not that amazing. It's a basic bi-level home. You see bi-levels everywhere in South Boulder, but it had one unique characteristic, and that was the two-car detached garage.
Mm.
And two-car detached garages are relatively rare. In the future, it's possible that those garages could be turned into ADUs. In fact, I strongly suspect that that's going to happen given the regulatory trend that exists in Colorado and in the city of Boulder. But it's a basic 4-bed, 2-bath bi-level, of which there are many. This one is mine.
Should we coin it the Boulder rectangle? Because you got the Denver square.
No, okay. It's just... people that know that this bi-level thing, look, they're not bad houses, but the big negative is the moment you walk in the door, you're confronted by stairs. And a lot of people don't like that.
I was surprised the big advantage to find that out, yeah.
The big advantage is once you're on the upper level, the whole upper level is elevated, so you feel a little bit like you're in kind of a treehouse feel, and the lower level is above grade in most cases, at least partially above grade.
Mm-hmm.
So it has better light. That's the big advantages of bi-levels. And basements don't feel dark and decrepit.
As deep,
like, yeah. Yeah, but it was priced about right, in my opinion, for a bi-level with a one-car garage. It was priced just under $1 million.
They didn't slash it or anything? They didn't drop the price.
Well, it was let's talk about that. So it was originally listed March 21st, and it was its first listing. It was on the market literally a few days before it went under contract, and the offer was so strong it didn't go to active backup. It went right to pending.
Mm.
And eventually it sold. It sold for it sold 60,000 over list.
Yeah.
And with a normal conforming loan, and then the buyer clawed back 16.5. So I think that what happened here is they paid a lot more than list price, and then they asked the seller to contribute to buy down points, or maybe it was an inspection negotiation. It's unclear what that $16,000 was for. But the remodeling, so it was marketed as a remodeled property, but if you look at the photos, it's like, okay, maybe early 2000s era remodeling. The blue tile is kind of vibrant. The concrete countertops are
fine.
That
feels kind of newer.
Oh, no, it's not concrete. It's tiled granite.
It's a mix.
I don't know. I think it's not that new. I mean, it's nice that it was done by an owner and probably not a flip.
Yeah.
Right? That is definitely an advantage. But it's not high. It's not like a high-end remodel. And it's at least a few years old. But it's turnkey and livable. I mean, I like the glass. You know, look at the lower level bath, the glass top, the smoked kind of aquamarine glass top. But it's sort of I would call it average remodel. But it's turnkey. It's ready to go. And then it has this really, really nice feature of a 572 square foot garage.
Yeah. Like,
that's a lot of space. It's bigger, way bigger than a two-car garage,
talking about
right?
my car collection, right?
Right, yeah. Exactly. And this particular location, you on one side, and this is a lot of people don't know about this location, like on one side you've got, if you head east, you can get into Tantra Park.
Mm.
And Tantra Park has a social trail that connects to CU South. And it's unclear how that will be maintained and what will happen at CU South. But not all of CU South is going to be developed. Some of it will still be open space, and CU has promised that the public will still be able to access it. So I suspect that pass through Tantra Park into CU South will still be there. There's a great little sledding hill there. There's a playground right at the end of the street. On the other side, you can easily walk over to or stroll over to the Table Mesa Shopping Center with Whole Foods and Southern Sun and all of those
Walnut
things.
Cafe.
Southside Walnut.
Yeah,
yeah, and Sweet Cow. Excuse me one second. I'm just going to cough. I'm going to mute the mic when I cough so I don't cough into it.
Very respectful. No, and back to, I think we discussed this in pod 41, perhaps pod 40. With that detached garage, the kind of ADU potential once these occupancy and zoning laws begin to take effect or become a little bit more opaque.
Don't count on it exactly. I mean, there's so many rules that govern it, particularly solar access could still, you know, shoot you in the foot.
Mm-hmm.
The rules are going to loosen, and having the existing structure is generally advantageous, but it doesn't mean you could turn it into an ADU by right.
No.
Did somebody overpay for it? I think they probably paid a little more than they needed to get this place, but at the same time, we don't know the backstory. We don't know how many competitive offers were actually present, and I wouldn't believe anything the listing agent says. No offense to her. I've done deals with her. She's great, but she won't disclose that either, ever.
Yeah, that's just how that goes.
You have to ply people with alcohol to find that out because they don't want you to know. If there was only one offer and this person spent $65,000 or let's call it $55,000 or $50,000 over list to get it, they don't want the world to know that there was only one offer. I've been on that side where there was only one offer and we're maintaining the illusion of multiple offers.
I bet the neighborhood's stoked by the premium, though. You know,
well, maybe some of the neighbors might be pissed because it increases their taxes, right?
If that's a good point. Comps. Double-edged sword, yeah.
It's not always good. We're not California where property taxes are fundamentally capped. Our property taxes keep going up. So I know Tabor was supposed to keep that reasonable, but our politicians have figured out how to eviscerate Tabor.
Yeah.
They got their 2 pounds. All right, so that's 4380 Whitney Place. Great house, and that two-car detached garage, I think, is what drove the bidding war, as well as it being livable. You know, move in now. It doesn't really need anything, although it's also not a flip, which I personally would prefer.
Mm-hmm.
A home like this that's got a remodel that's a few years old compared to a flip that was done for a profit, and God knows how many corners they cut
Yeah, right.
when they built it.
Yeah.
But there you have it. That's 4380. And the other one I wanted to talk about, Hamish, did you have anything to add?
Not really. I liked that home. I don't, you know, I haven't looked at the market or the neighborhoods or anything, so I can't really comment too much on price, but I, you know, it's got a big garage and I like the light in the basement. That kind of layout is actually pretty preferred personally. So
Yeah, it's got a big, exactly. It's got a big garage. It's livable. I personally am not crazy about bi-levels and tri-levels, but I'm like a parent or a teacher. There's no bad kids. It's just, you know,
10 out of 10 would occupy.
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. So, right. Let's move on to 421 Mapleton Ave, Unit A. So this building was constructed in 1906, and in my 20 years of living in Boulder, I've heard a lot of rumors about this building, but if you take Mapleton Ave all the way to the west side, right before you cross 4th Street, you will see this building on the north side of the avenue. And it's comprised of, I don't know, maybe 6 units, 7 units. It could be 8. And they each have their own address on the A and B sides. And they're really small, right? Like, this is the original apartment.
618. Oh, yeah, we're going to get into that.
Right? It's a one-bed, one-bath with 618 square feet. And when you show these, you realize, wow, they are tiny. And it would be challenging for this to be a full-time residence without a very minimal footprint in terms of your consumption, in terms of your clothing, your gear.
Yeah.
But they do have one-car detached garages. I think they all have them, although I'm not 100% on that. This unit did. And 421 Mapleton hit the market a while ago. So this is one of those deals that I'm kind of surprised. I mean, they did list it high. They listed it at $750. And then that was back in October. After a month, they dropped it to $700. And then it just sat there. They didn't pull it off in the holiday season. Somebody decided, okay, you know, I like this. Let's give them a low offer that they could refuse. And they negotiated a really substantial discount. So the last list price was $700, and the closing price was $605. So kudos to the buy-side agent, who we know well, Mary Beth Emerson. I will name her because I think she's a very competent agent, and I love doing deals with her on the other side because she's professional and knows what she's doing. And she does a lot of Mapleton Hill. But she managed to drop it to $605 for her client, which is an excellent deal. It was a cash deal.
Pretty hefty, yeah.
And so this property would be great as like a, you know, pied de terre. You already own something in Mapleton Hill and you want a guest room for your in-laws when the grandparents come to visit, or maybe you've downsized, and when Junior comes to visit from college, you want them to have their own place. Whatever the reasons is, but for only $600.
Yeah.
You know, you're just doing an addition in Mapleton Hill. You could probably double that to try to get something substantial done. And in this case, you bought something historic that really is going to work well for that purpose. HOA is a little high, $645, but you're in Mapleton Hill. You're in the most desirable spot, one of the most desirable spots for sure in town. So I think this is a great buy. It would have been a good buy also for somebody that works at the academy or will work at the academy. I don't think it's going to be a problem ever renting this thing out because of the academy and downtown being so close. Mm-hmm. If you decided to rent it out, I think this is a really good place to park cash if that was the investor's or the buyer's motivation. We don't really know, but I think this is a great option. But here's the thing about this property. So these rumors I heard from, I heard all sorts of crazy things I've been in town for over 20 years. And the things I've heard are things like, well, it once upon a time it was like a home for, you know, people that have had babies out of wedlock. Like they couldn't have that with their family, so they stayed in these units. I don't know if any of that is true. But the architectural historic review says that the developer, Warren Dyer, was a prominent turn-of-the-century Boulder businessman who was involved in real estate and mining. The building is also significant, being a terrace-style apartment building on Mapleton Hill, an area otherwise marked by large, stately, single-family residences. And that is from the historic review of, what date is that? 1979. No, that's the quad year. I think it was in the 90s, these historic reviews. This one's actually typed.
Like typewriter typed or type?
You know, typewriter typed. That's kind of cool. Yeah, so Churchill and Dyer, W.D. Churchill and W.C. Dyer, built this apartment building in 1897. So the dates might be wrong on the listing. 1897, and each occupied an apartment there for many years. Churchill was Warren Dyer's father-in-law. Dyer was Boulder County Sheriff for two terms. He was also involved in real estate and mining, platted Dyer's subdivision, developed Newlands Addition, and was influential in getting the streetcar line extended into North Boulder. And he also raised honey.
You raised honey?
Raised honey.
Yeah.
That's what it says. Raised honey on the history. Look, this is via the Colorado Historical Society historic building inventory record.
Should I link this?
And yeah, if you want to. It's right out of the Carnegie Library. I love going to the Carnegie Library for this. Yeah, that's the historic review.
So two things.
And it's a 1996 survey that talked about original construction date. Yeah.
So before we pivot, is there any, I guess, like HOA reserves and dues aside, are there any kind of physical due diligence items with these old brick constructions?
Oh my God, Hamish, that's like a whole podcast.
Oh, jeez. Okay. Well, I was just curious.
Yes. So historic. All right. When you're buying a historic property, whether it's an apartment like this or it's a standalone single family house, you should expect much deeper levels of due diligence, and you should be prepared to spend as much as twice as a newer house would cost in maintenance. Mm. You should look really closely at the foundation. A lot of Mapleton Hill homes and historic homes in general in Boulder were built from fieldstone foundations. So these cobblestone foundations or fieldstone foundations shift and move over time. They're much more prone to that. And so there's lots of signs of stabilization in these over the years. The ultimate fix is to lift up the whole building and put a real foundation in it. And imagine the complexity of that with eight other units.
Yep.
Okay.
And then the city of Boulder watching you.
I'm not saying it does.
Yeah.
Okay. I have no idea. I have not personally examined the foundation of this building, but the historic review of, due diligence for historic properties should go really deep. And with an HOA, there's another layer of due diligence involving whether the HOA is healthy or not, whether there are adequate reserves, how is it being managed. And I've already shared the story of HOA presidents and these little micro HOAs that suddenly treat it like a fiefdom and take over public areas for their own personal use, and all sorts of craziness happens in associations. So do not skip your due diligence on the association either. But what you should be thinking about is, what are you getting for your dues? Are you buying into $15 million of reserves for your $600 a month? Because that's pretty nice. You're not going to get hit with a special assessment.
Yeah.
Is the association paying for electricity and gas and water? Are they going to cover the cost of the roof in 3 years, or is that a special assessment for you?
Because it looks like a flat roof.
How have they been doing?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It could be a flat roof. How have they been doing? So, and it can be challenging because you can't personally inspect all the other units, but you might be on the hook for fixing something that's wrong with the foundation. So you want to read through the association docs. You want to talk to the association members, board members in particular.
There's a ton, it sounds like.
And you should be thinking in terms of less bad, not good.
Oh, yeah, good
degrees
point.
Of less bad.
Yeah.
Like none of them, I've yet to hear
could
somebody
be worse.
Go, oh my God, I love my association. It's been great. So happy to be part of the association.
Proud member of.
Let me know.
Bumper sticker on.
Right. Proud member of my homeowners association. Yeah.
That'd be a pretty good tongue-in-cheek sticker to have, actually.
my money and my time go to my HOA. All right, so
I drive this so my HOA can look like this. Oh, okay, moving on.
Yeah, let's move on from
HOA memes.
421 Mapleton. Yeah. So I think somebody got a great deal, and kudos to Mary Beth, who is a friend and a colleague and somebody I respect a lot in the business. She's rock solid. So good job, Mary Beth.
Yeah.
Okay. In the news, maybe we end up over an hour, Hamish. We are coming up an hour, and we haven't even touched on the news yet.
We're looking there. I think we could make Barbara a pretty short news segment, because she kind of ties into the market conditions, so we could probably move through her pretty quick.
All right. Yeah. We will give Barbara the short treatment.
Yeah. Sorry, Barb.
And I think Barbara would say no one gives Barbara the short treatment, Osmond. She is a very feisty, strong-willed human being. So if you look at the Boulder Reporting Lab, there was an article published this week that is about a proposed micro-unit development in downtown Boulder, and it's supposed to be serving as a test case for new housing density policies. So this is a 45-unit apartment building, and I think we're talking about 22nd and Pearl. Yep, 22nd and Pearl. 45 units, and each of these units is tiny. 45 residential units. And the square footage of those units is really, well, if you thought this Mapleton Hill apartment was small at 600-something square feet, these are in the 300-something, these 45 units. And then there's commercial space on the main level. I think they were talking about roughly 2,000 square feet of commercial space. And the developer Stock Investment Group, with offices in Boulder, plan to use robotic furniture to optimize limited space. Oh. For example, the bed can be manually or electronically raised from the floor to the ceiling to make space for a desk. And then there's communal space throughout the property, lockers and bike storage provided on site. And they're talking about rent at roughly $2,500 a month, which people can rent. That's almost the price of a very small ranch in South Boulder, right? We've seen it's not that far off renting a three-bedroom.
Yeah.
I think we have a three-bedroom, one bath that's renting at roughly this number.
Yeah.
Right? And that's like 1,000 square feet.
That's dang near my mortgage.
Right. That's dang near your mortgage. And you are getting 300 square feet. But look, your bed goes up and down, hopefully with you not in it, robotically.
And hey, you're in Boulder.
And then East magically Pearl. A desk appears under it, but you're in Boulder. And so this is being pitched as workforce housing.
Yeah, that's
and right. And this quote, and I'm not going to mention the planning board member. You can read that yourself. I'm not trying to make enemies of people in Boulder. But the quote is, this is somebody questioning it.
Yeah.
Right. So, all right, let me read the pitch. The developers have pitched the project as housing for employees who would otherwise have to commute. As such, they plan to price the units so the renters earning about 100% of the area's median income spend no more than 30% of their income on rent. So that translates to someone earning $102,000 per year, spending no more than $2,500 a month. And one of the planning board members says, which workforce is making $100,000 a year and willing to live in 300 square feet?
Yeah.
That's my biggest concern. Yeah, ours too.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The size of it's just astounding that this is being developed. And Hamish, you were saying, you know, which workers?
Yeah,
workers come
like tradies is what I'm thinking of.
Right. So some tradespeople are definitely making six figures, especially like electricians and certain plumbers. But they come with tools.
They got baggage. Yeah, and like
they can't live it. They're not going to live at 300 square feet.
No, and it says here too, right, they're going to subsidize alternative transport. Do you see an electrician riding a bus with, you know, their Milwaukee, like, pack-out set? Or, you know, like, it's curious. Maybe, like, tech workers? But it's just very strange.
In New York City, 300 square feet would have been really tight. People do it. But that's New York City.
Yeah.
We're not New York City. And people's, if they're making $100,000 a year, likely they're more interested in an actual house with a yard. And unfortunately, the city of Boulder doesn't have that as an option.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to cough again, so I'm going to pause for a second.
I thought you were just getting more and more poignant. Another note is reading further into the article, too. It sounds like they did their planned proposal, or they submit their plan to submit a proposal to Boulder in 2021. And apparently they were thinking of being a lot more affordable, though, you know, pandemic, yada, yada. Even then, I don't know how affordable 300 square feet would have to be to become all the rage.
I don't know what the developer's smoking.
Something good.
And I really don't think that this is going to be a successful investment for them. But, you know, I guess you got to take the risk and find out, because if they can get 2,500 a square, you know, this building pays for itself in 10 years. I think it's a very interesting investment play. It's experimental. I don't know of people willing to spend that much money that make that kind of income to live in such a small space, no matter the amenities. But it'll be very interesting to see. And obviously, I'm very skeptical of this particular project.
Yeah, me too. So, Barbara.
All right, yeah. You want to move us along?
Yeah.
Got it. So, our second news article, Barbara's talking about the Augustus Gloop effect too, and says we are going to go through the roof, but she doesn't know when.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, Barbara's not an economist. She's a very, very successful real estate professional, shark tank shark.
I see her. I just think of the theme music in the background.
And I've never actually seen Shark Tank, but she's talking about the bottleneck in the market. And how when interest rates drop, prices are going to go through the roof. And I don't know if she's wrong. She could be right there, because clearly the Augustus Gloop effect is happening and rates could drop. But here, you know, here's the thing that everyone is struggling to understand what the Fed is doing, what the U.S. economy is doing, how inflation and the U.S. dollar go hand in hand with a global environment, and then also a global environment that is decoupling from China. There's so much happening, and it's very challenging to make predictions. In fact, I've been wrong. I kept saying rates are going to come down. I've been saying that now for 2 years, and I've been wrong. Rates are going up, and we're printing more money. So I think what my current prediction is, rates are going to be in this range for the foreseeable future, because we have no discipline with our federal deficit, and we're going to print a ton of money to pay it. That's what's going to happen, which is going to keep driving inflation. So this is where I want to segue, and it's to a gentleman named Keith. I now remember his name, and I met him because I was renting his barn on Nantucket. My ex and I rented his barn to live in for the winter, and this barn had been probably illegally converted into a little two-bedroom apartment. One-bedroom apartment. Didn't have two bedrooms. And it was literally, it had no insulation. We froze.
Dang.
And our utility bill was insane.
Nantucket's northern, right?
Nantucket is a little island off the coast of Massachusetts.
Okay, yeah, so it's north.
And so this was the barn behind the amazing house right downtown. And Keith had been a developer of nuclear power plants and was a CEO of a firm that built and builds and maintains, I guess, nuclear power plants. And I felt very fortunate to actually be in the same room as this guy, okay? And we met. He visited on an island, and he's, of course, in the main house. And then he took us out for coffee or tea or lunch. I can't remember, but I got to talk to him for a little bit. And my first question for him was, like, you know, when did you buy your first house, and what was that like? And he had bought his house in the 70s during a period of very high inflation. And I said, wow, you had a 11% rate or whatever it was. It was nuts. He's like, yeah, it was nuts to laugh. He laughed. He goes, to think back on those days. And I was like, well, what was that like for you as, you know, first-time home buyer at the time? And he said that it was no big deal because his income was growing much faster.
Mm.
So he locked in this rate, which at the time seemed outrageous, but his income rapidly escalated much higher because of inflation. Inflation drove his income high, so it didn't matter. He's like, all I did was just pay off my mortgage faster.
That's a good point.
So that is something to think about. Incomes will likely rise across the board on average to keep up with inflation, which will pay off mortgages faster in an inflationary environment. That's something to just ponder as a possibility. I'm not saying that's definitely what's going to happen.
Nor is it like application, right? It's just kind of how things go.
Well, if you think about it, like if you ask them the magic eight ball, what are the odds that inflation is going to, what are the odds mortgage rates are going to be 9% next year,
mm-hmm.
or 11% next year, or in 2 years? Is there, what is the probability of that happening? Forget about the 8 ball.
Okay.
Let's ask ourselves. It's not non-zero.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? We know it's not zero. And we know the government is spending money like it's going out of style. And we know we have this massive amount of national debt that we just keep adding to. And so what is the only way out? And it's the inflation of assets, or it's the devaluation of the dollar. And both of them lead us to the same place. And I just imagine
just numbers go up.
A world where rates would be lower, but it's wrong. Rates are higher in those types of scenarios. So I am now putting my rates are going to drop forecast.
You're benching it
to the side, yeah. Irrespective of Barbara's perspective on this. And I'm going to say rates for the foreseeable future are hovering in this 6.5% to 7.5% range. And they could go significantly higher, and they probably will until the inflation genie is tamed. And it's quite possible the inflation genie won't be tamed for years because of our lack of fiscal discipline as a country.
Yeah, the seeming disinterest in taming.
There's no political will, Hamish. It's not disinterest.
Yeah.
There's people sounding the alarm bell. They're talking about what's called a debt crisis. And there's quite possibly we're headed there. We're headed into Argentina-like behavior with our currency, too.
Yeah.
Where we're, you know, you're not going to have to carry wheelbarrows. It's all digital.
But still, no, and that's kind of going on to it is, you know, we got to see close to or dang near zero during the pandemic as far as rates go. From the Fed, not, you know, on the lending side. But it's very possible that, you know, 5% is considered zero at a certain point because that's all that's manageable anymore. Yeah. How about that?
Okay. All right. Well, I really don't know. Yeah. I just can't believe I was so convinced rates have to come down because of the cost to refinance our debt, but they're not. And if they're not, that means one thing: we're printing more money to pay the debt. It can't be both.
Well, the Fed's doing well.
That doesn't, I mean, yeah, well, that's a whole, yeah. Let's not go down the conspiracy rabbit hole, Hamish. I saw the little twinkle in your eye. We're not all doing right, it.
Fine.
Let's move to our next news story.
Over to kind of a conspiracy theory news story.
Well, so this link will be in the description to annoy you, but it does bring up a very interesting possibility. And this is not the possibility of civil war, although that's also non-zero in the future. I think it's much more mobility caused by our political divisiveness between red and blue states. I don't think we're headed to civil war in the next few years, but I do think that people that are more aligned with blue politics are going to move to places that are blue, and people that are more aligned to red politics are going to move to places that are red. And the media is going to keep amping up on this distinction where blue media will talk about how horrific red states are for people that are
X,
that
Y,
are,
and Z.
That are women or are any rainbow of any kind. They're going to say it's horrific. It's oppressive to women. It's oppressive to people that are LGBTQ to be in a red state. And I'm not saying it's not. It is. From what I can tell, it might be. It certainly looks that way internally within our conversations as a team. We see our clients. People are already moving from Florida. We've had Texas. New clients move here and choose us from Texas, yeah. Because they... I mean, they don't like the red states are like, look at all the blue state run cities. They're full of homelessness, crimes, and drugs, and it's horrible. You wouldn't want to live in those places. So I'm sure there's people leaving blue states too for red places.
There are, yeah.
And I think so. About 20 years ago, I wrote an article on my House Einstein blog. It wasn't called that at the time, but you might still be able to find it. And it was about cultural creatives and the mobility of cultural creatives. And the thesis was that look, today, talent and capital are mobile, and that means that they can vote with their feet,
yeah,
to where they want to be. And so creatives are creating companies in places they want to live for the weather and for the politics and for the friendship circles. And I think that's only accelerating even harder now. It's not just about creativity. It's about fleeing places that feel like, and maybe it's real or not, feel like political persecution. feel like that you're not safe to be in those places if you don't conform to whatever the majority is in that spot.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to dance around certain topics.
I think you're doing a wonderful job. Because I don't want to
offend anybody.
Yeah.
Well, look, we work with Republicans. We work with Democrats. Right. I'm an independent, and I'm very proud of that. I think both political parties are full of hypocrisy. But I see this trend in our client base, and that tells me that we're going to keep seeing this. I don't think the pressure, I don't think our country is coming back together in a big kumbaya moment
yeah.
of love and harmony and understanding with each other. There's too much money involved with separating and dividing us, unless we're at war. And that's the only time it seems like we get our ducks in a row and act as one country. And even then, we're pretty much at each other's throat within 3 months yeah. afterward. So
anyways, people
it
move.
It is relevant. People move, and people are going to move more
yeah.
in the future. And you may want to be thinking about that in terms of your own real estate choices to own, to hold, to sell. I don't see Boulder becoming less attractive, short of major climate change risk accelerating much faster than expected. But then I don't think any place is safe.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah. What'd you call it? Creative mobility?
Cultural creatives that are driving mobility.
Yeah.
Yep. Talent and capital are mobile.
It strikes a very similar chord to kind of the vote with your dollar thing, you know, kind of the free market. If you're free to move, then you get to choose where you spend your money. So it's kind of cool little parallel. And yeah, with the whole work from home and internet, we're going to see a whole lot more of it.
Well, and at all ages, yeah. I mean, our clients buying in Table Mesa right now are a young family with 3 kids. Mm-hmm. We have older folks that we represent on the buy and sell side, but the buy side is not uncommon. We actually just had a closing. Mm-hmm. Grandparents that want to be close to their grandkids. And so there's a migration happening
yeah.
in our country.
And where it's...
And it's something to be aware
yeah.
of.
I mean, I guess I could keep going, but...
You had one more thought.
Yeah, where it's easier to move and be somewhere you know is better than to work in the ground that you stand is kind of an interesting new development, I guess, you know, because it's like, if I know it's just going to be better over there, then I'll just shoot and go over there. And I'm curious to see how that's going to change the landscape over time, because I'm thinking like pre-internet or pre-work from home, people were kind of more based where they were. Like there was still travel and stuff, but it was a little bit more of an undertaking. I think it's a lot easier to be mobile at this point. So I think the landscape as far as kind of how counties and states and lines are drawn up is going to change pretty drastically. Yeah.
Well, you don't know this. You may not know this about me. I don't think you know this about me, but I studied animal behavior and biology in undergrad and for a few years in grad school, but not as part of my official graduate program. Mm. And I was involved in studying populations of frogs,
yeah.
anurans, primarily in Puerto Rico and in the Northeast. And I was just an assistant, but I learned a lot. And one of the things I remember learning in one of my animal behavior seminars was that populations within the population of frogs, there are individuals that are dispersers and yeah. there are individuals that are nesters. And dispersers, and you see this sometimes within families, right? Like one of the family members is like, I'm out.
My mom.
And that would be me and my yeah. family, right? I'm so far from all the rest of my family members in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. And then there's lots of people that the entire genetic drift of the family is like within 3 towns.
Yeah.
Like the entire family is within 3 towns. They're not going
they're
anywhere.
They're nesters. Yeah.
They're largely nesters, but there might be some weirdo in the family that's like, I'm out. I'm moving to Boulder. Yeah. And that might be me and my family.
I mean, that's how I ended up being from New Zealand. So, yeah, the drifters.
I mean, my family is actually originally from Punjab. So, 100%. Whether through political changes that they couldn't change, they were forced to move, or they chose to move for opportunity and freedom. My family is actually 100% dispersers.
Yeah.
I joke about the nesting. They're really not nesters.
Good point. Okay.
All right.
So this was supposed to be the big chunk of the podcast. We're now an hour and 20 minutes in.
Let's see if we can wrap this up quickly, because you know it does sound a little like a pitch, And I don't want to pitch too hard to our audience, dear audience. I don't want you being subject to just constant pitches from me. I find, I don't know why, I always find that sort of offensive, sort of how like a podcast will go from the podcast people talking to suddenly being in an ad. It, I feel very deceptive.
I always get whiplash on those.
It drives me crazy. And I just feel like it's really good to be honest in some ways. And there's, I think this is a topic that's really important, but it also is a topic that contrasts how we do things compared to how a lot of other brokerages do things. And we'll try to keep it short. So this is the segment called Tell Me Something I Don't Know. And after 20 years in the industry, I'm convinced that the vast majority of buyers and sellers or consumers of real estate services don't really know what they're paying for. And it's partially driven by the fact that there's a lot of money being spent on marketing of real estate brokerages. And it's driven by the fact that people don't do enough transactions in a lifetime to know the difference between very high quality service and, oh yeah, they found the house and we got the deal done. They can't tell the difference because there's no benchmarking. There's no discussion. There's no real discussion of actual services rendered. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's all hype. And you see this in certain brokerages like Compass and a new one, The Agency, right? It's even shinier of a wrapper. Yeah. And I have nothing against the agents or the agency itself, other than to draw a very clear distinction between their approach and their strategy versus ours. Ours is all about helping people make smart decisions, and theirs are all about, like, it is shiny wrapper dumb.
Luxury. Right?
The shinier, the fancier. Like, one of our colleagues in Denver has a partnership with a Bentley dealership, like, and his videos show Bentleys in them, and I'm like,
cool cars.
This is not our... And he has very attractive-looking models frequently in the videos, and I'm like, well, that looks like fun, but... We're not like that's not the value add that I mean. Look, so I came to the conclusion that we also have a shiny wrapper when it comes to selling our listings and representing our sellers. Right? We want to position the house in its best light. We want to tell the story effectively in a way that moves people and potentially gets people to look at a property they might not have otherwise, mm-hmm. and hopefully pay a premium for the product. That's our job on the sell side. On the buy side, we're much more about property selection and negotiation and due diligence. So both things are important, but it's all framed up with a wrapper of here's the information, here's what works, here's what doesn't, here's how we help you prepare the home in its highest and best way, here's how we stage it, here's how we photograph it, here's how we tell the story and videography, here's how we spend money on our marketing and push it out there to the world.
Here's how it goes.
It's competition of the real versus competition of the image. And competition of the image is like, look how good I look in front of this amazing house. And look at how shiny my brand is as an agency. And here are all these things that are actually not really competitive, like private client networks that sometimes get deals done.
Are getting advertised.
But for all the things we've all the reasons we've talked about many times is smoke and mirrors, right? Yeah. It's not actually adding value to the transaction. And sometimes people buy a house through that. They feel like they wouldn't have heard about it otherwise, but it's pretty rare.
Yeah. And I think you briefly touched on it too. It's like we have to have a shiny wrapper to a certain extent. And also if we want to stay in business, we do need to attract clients. But it's difficult because we don't want to just be shiny. We want to be helping you make a smarter real estate decision, right? We want to be that due diligence support and that kind of get ahead of the curve, know what we're selling before we sell it type of brokerage. And it's just
I mean, we could take this to the car analogy because you and I are both car people.
And right? Now you are too, listener.
And now you are unfortunately pulled into this. But if you are a car person and you understand the car branding ecosystem, you know there are certain brands that have very shiny wrappers. And I would say Fiat is one of those, right?
Yeah.
And Fiat, you know, they're very sexy cars, but they're horrible. They're so unreliable. Yeah. Like everything objectively says these are really poorly built, unreliable vehicles. Why would you buy such a thing? And it's because of image. It's because it's cool. It's because it's hip. And there's an audience for that, 100%. There's also an audience for Lexus. Mm-hmm. And Lexus backs up their quality by being number one or number two on every single survey of quality. And having owned one of these 2 decades before I was old enough to, I bought a used one, and then we had to go to the dealership to have service done on this LS. I was commuting back and forth to Denver. I LS wanted 400? Like a really LS 430. Nice. I wanted a really quiet car. And this was like a German knockoff of a Mercedes E-Class. And a Japanese knockoff of a German Mercedes 300 E-Class. I was scared to service it myself because I was worried that this could be so complicated. It turned out nothing was complicated. Everything was so well engineered. But I had to go into the dealership because they needed to remove the OnStar system. Which, of course, the only problems I ever had that with that car were from the American side, like the Mark 11 stereo and that dumb OnStar system that Lexus decided to put in there. So the dealership experience was so concierge and so professional and so nice. It was astounding. And I later sold the car. And at one point, I bought your favorite brand, BMW. And dealing with the BMW dealership here in Boulder was like...
Shark Tank.
Oh, my God. Was awful. Was awful in such an incredible way that I vowed never to buy another one. It was just such a horrific experience.
I don't blame you, man.
And unfortunately... The Lexuses are so boring. No offense to Lexus owners. I owned one. They're great, but you got to check to see if you're still alive in the car. It's like it's so numbed out.
Especially those 430s. I mean, they're big boat cruisers. They're fantastic.
It was so amazing for what I drove, what we had it for. It was definitely my favorite big full-size sedan ever for how comfortable and quiet it was. But it was a grandpa mobile.
Yeah.
It was so tomb-like. But the point I'm trying to make is that Lexus backs up that brand with the service experience. And there are a lot of brokerages that have a shiny wrapper brand, and the individual agent may or may not back it up with service, right? Mm-hmm. Like I often will talk about the agents I think that are killing it, that are doing a good job, that I respect as colleagues. And guess what? Their brand has nothing to do with what they're doing.
You don't say Mary Beth Emerson of X, right? You said Mary Beth Emerson.
Yeah. Right, because it has nothing to do with the agency that she's with, and now I'm getting very specific, so please forgive me, Mary Beth, for bringing even you into this podcast, and I hope you don't hear it. I hope you hear the admiration and not me being critical. But she's very competent, and there's other agents in that brokerage that are likely not, and we know that is true of Compass, and we know you can be a first-time agent and hang your license at Compass. Mm-hmm. And so be very cognizant of what services you're actually getting. In addition to choosing a brokerage based on their branding, I mean, there is some feeling like Liv Sotheby's, well, that must have some connection with the Sotheby's auction, right? Well, not really. The Sotheby's auction is like brand extension to a brokerage. Just like people know Warren Buffett, know Berkshire Hathaway. Berkshire Hathaway, the investment company, has nothing to do with Berkshire Hathaway, the real estate brokerage, other than Warren Buffett making a ton of money and his company making a ton of money from the brand extension.
I always wondered on that. Yeah.
So this is individual agents. I mean, our brokerage is different because our mission is actually helping people be smart.
All right, we're selective.
And we're very selective and probably not going to grow because of that. I don't see a need to. Yeah. And it's so we have such a tight team and we work so well together that the challenge of adding somebody right now, especially with so much changes happening, it certainly won't be anybody that's new in the business. And even if it's somebody that's well experienced, the answer is almost certainly no, because of all the challenges of adding people to our brand and our brokerage. We don't need to. We have a really happy experience working together. We're really effective in the size that we are. So anyway, what buyers and sellers don't know is that it is the service you get has almost nothing to do with most brokerages' brands. Mm-hmm. It has to do with the agents individually. And you want to ask specific questions around what value they're creating for you, especially as you go to renegotiate with those people for buy-side commissions, which is going to start in July. You better start asking tough questions about what you're actually getting from these people.
Yeah. It's almost as though the brokerage is for the agent and the agent is for the client. Right. If you're a client, you're shopping for the agent. And if you're an agent, you're shopping for the brokerage. It's not really the brokerage doesn't really have any direct influence on the client's services.
Yes and okay. No. Some brokerages have some services that are valuable, but they're not necessarily well delivered. Imagine you're a new agent and you have no idea what you're doing. Well, you want to go with the brand that gives you the most extension of competency, that paints you with a competent logo, right? So I have no idea what I'm doing. I'm going to go to Coldwell, Remax. I'm going to go to Compass because whether or not they offer training and support, they make me look like I have the Compass card, right? I have the card that says they've spent hundreds of millions on their marketing. And even though I got my license yesterday and can barely fog a mirror, I now have a Compass card. So people assume that means competency. And that's why a new agent chooses a certain brand. Mm-hmm. More seasoned agents, it depends. I'm pretty convinced that when Compass was on a buying spree and we're buying agents everywhere, and those people became founding brokers, they got pretty good stock deals. Yeah. I think they got a sweetheart deal on splits. They were promised a lot of service, which I don't know if it's true they got it or not. You'll have to ask a Compass agent.
Probably grandfathered a founding agent to that.
You may have to get them a little drunk and they have to be a close friend for you to hear the truth. But ask them if they're really getting the services they were promised. But those early agents got very, very good deals. And at some point, they're probably going to leave because that stock has been in the tank for a long time. Mm-hmm. And given the lawsuits involved with Compass, I doubt that their brand is... Oh, well, we'll see what happens, right?
We will see.
You want to squeeze them, but the lawyers in that lawsuit want to squeeze Compass, but they don't want Compass to fail because then they don't get paid.
It's...
Right?
Yeah, that's a good point. Good balance there from the lawyers. Got to do their best.
You can't force Compass into perpetual bankruptcy and then can't service its obligation to pay a settlement. That doesn't work. But you talk to agents to ask what they're getting. So more seasoned agents are going to want higher levels of service and competency. They're going to want to see colleagues that know what they're doing and are not a distraction and an embarrassment. Mm-hmm. There are some big brokerages where
that's a good point.
Senior agents stay there, but they don't really like the fact that you could fog a mirror and get a business card with the name of the brokerage on it because they feel like their value is actually diminished. And they
built something
by allowing.
No, it's just
And I'm pretty sure we saw a lot of people leave Remax because of that, because they felt like it's the Kmart brand of real estate, like it doesn't have luxury connotation to it.
And their branding has stayed relatively consistent too.
It's sort of like stuck in the early 2000s. Yeah. And that's why Coldwell and Remax and some of these other large brands have like their Premier's version. Like they have a...
Or their teams.
Like Redfin. Yeah. Redfin has a Premier version, right? Because Redfin is associated with discount. So they have Redfin Prestige or Redfin, you're not the discount version.
Redfin money sign. Dollar sign.
Right. Redfin in blue instead of red, but now you're a Redfin blue. You're a blue
fin. Now you're tuna.
Whatever it is, right? Now you're tuna. Well, they're trying to get you away from the discount stigma with some of these brokerages or the middle market stigma with, say, Coldwell or Remax. And Compass and the agency and a couple of others have the... And Sotheby's, I think... I would say have a stigma associated with luxury. Yeah.
Sotheby's,
and that's why
sure.
some of the agents that, yeah, but I can tell you that's why some of these agents are choosing them because the connotation of luxury helps buyers and sellers of luxury homes say, oh, that's the person.
Those are the people.
Because look, they have fancy houses and drive a Bentley or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. But that's not the actual service of real estate. So all of that falls under the shiny wrapper category. Okay. Mm-hmm. The actual services of real estate. Now we need to end this podcast. Well, but if you're a regular listener, I don't think I need to go into it. All the things we do and all the things some agents do.
Yeah.
So ask about what you're actually getting. And with that, Hamish, we are now 100% an hour and a half podcast.
The 90-minute standard.
Wrap it up.
If you've made it this far, congratulations and great work. We're so soaked that you made it this far. Go ahead and make sure to like the video, like the podcast if it's possible on your platform. If you're not on YouTube, we love the feedback. Go ahead and leave those comments. We love the messages. Seeing you out in the wild, it's always a surprise meeting people who are like, oh, we recognize you from the podcast. Insane. Keep that up. We love it. If you'd like to learn a little bit more about us, you can find us on our website. There's the About Us tab. There's also a newsletter tab. You can find some really well-written pieces on fresh listings, which we can't talk about on publicly dispersed mediums, such as this one. So sign up on the newsletter. Get the inside scoop. It's written by Osman. He's a great writer. And
there will be one in April, there will be. Promise. It's going to happen. I've got six days. Got there will be one going out. It's happening. All right.
Yeah, and our other social media. We're on Instagram, fairly active, Facebook. We're not... We have a presence on TikTok, but X is also really good, or Twitter. So, yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for joining us, and if you'd like to learn more, visit us at HouseEinstein.com.
That's right.